The Yeshiva Sha'arei Torah is proud to present a lecture series on Jewish history by Rabbi Beryl Wine. This is the first in the series entitled The Beginning of the Second Commonwealth, delivered November the 28th, 1984.
Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in the year 586 before the Common Era. And the Jewish community was sent into exile into two different places in the world. Now, the 10 northern tribes, which were the majority of the Jewish people, approximately 1 million to 1.5 million Jews, were exiled in the year 732 before the Common Era, which with a quick mathematical mind is about 150 years earlier. In those 150 years, miraculously, they disappeared. They just disappeared from the face of the earth. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin has the question whether they're ever coming back. What happened to them? And you all know that Jewish legend has them beyond the river Sambatyon, which is a magical river somewhere in the world that rests on Shabbos, but during the 6 days of the week, nobody could ever get across it. And you also know that during the Middle Ages, and we'll discuss it later, people came and claimed to be kings, princes, representatives of the 10 tribes. And two of them got away with it for a very long period of time. They were even recognized by the Vatican and extended credentials by the Pope of Rome as representatives of the lost 10 tribes. Of course, the Pope then believed the world was flat, so it's possible that he could have gotten away with that also. But what happened to the 10 tribes is one of the great historic mysteries, because we're not talking about the disappearance of 100 people. You're talking about the disappearance of 1 million people, well organized. Where did they go? What happened to them? Left in Yehuda were about 500,000 Jews. And Nebuchadnezzar, after a series of plots and revolutions, as discussed in the Novi Yirmiyah and discussed in Malachim, Nebuchadnezzar finally had his fill. Really, I mean, Kaviyochel, the Rabboni Shalom had his fill. And Nebuchadnezzar came, and he besieged Jerusalem. Thousands of people died in the siege. The Beis HaMikdash was burned to the ground, and the Jewish people were taken into exile. They went two places. 90% of them went to Bavel. 10% went to Mitzrayim, went to Egypt. The Radak says that there are two reasons why that was the breakdown. The first thing was that Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Bavel, and he took most of them as slaves back to Bavel, so therefore not many could escape. And secondly, there was an aversion of Jews going back to Mitzrayim because of the Isser and the Torah of not being allowed to return to Egypt. And in fact, the Rambam in a later generation who lived in Egypt, the Rambam lived in Cairo, used to sign his letters every day, Anochi Moshe ben Maimon, Hasfardi, Ho'over Bechol Yom Al Gimel Lavin Shabbatorah. He says, every day that I live here, I'm over on 3 Lavin, because the Rambam counts it in the Sefer HaMitzvahs and in the Yorah Chazoka as 3 separate Lavin to live in Mitzrayim. But what lent credence to the Jewish community of Mitzrayim is that the Novi Yirmiyah went with them to Mitzrayim. But the Jews who came to Bavel did not come to a completely non-Jewish country. And that is very important for us to understand always in Jewish history. How do exiles start and what happens when they get there? The Novi Yechezkel, the prophet Yechezkel, went into Golis 11 years earlier than the Churban. In the Tanakh, it tells us that Nebuchadnezzar came in 597 to Yerushalayim, and he deposed the king, Yechoniah, Yehoyachin. He deposed that king, and he took him back as a prisoner to Bavel, and he put a puppet king, Tzidkiyahu, the nephew of Yehoiachin, to be the king of Judah, that he would take care of his interests. Well, what happened was that Tzidkiyahu, after a while, believed that he was the king. That's a very big danger, to make somebody the king and tell him you're not really the king. Because after a period of time, you know, you really think that you are the king. And when he thought he was the king, he made a revolution, and then Nebuchadnezzar came again. But in any event, in Tanakh it says that he took with him Esachorosh Vesamazger. He took with him the artisans, Chorosh is the carpenters, Vesamazger the locksmiths. So the Gemara says, I mean, what does that mean? So the Gemara says he took all the Talmidei Chachomim in exile. 11 years earlier, he took the Sanhedrin, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rabbonim, all the Talmidei Chachomim, he took them into exile in Bavel. So when the other Jews came in 586, there was a shul, there was a yeshiva, there was a Beis Medrash, there was a mikveh. There was a Jewish community that was made by the Talmidei Chachomim. They were the ones that came first. And that's a rule that we have in the Golis. You'll remember that, please. Whoever came first shaped the Golis. The Talmidei Chachomim came first to North Africa and Spain, so that was one type of Golis. The Reformed Jews came first to the United States, so that's a different type of Golis. It depends who's at the door greeting you when you come. So if the Novi Yecheskel is standing at the door, and the Sanhedrin is, in so to speak, operating in Bavel, and all the yeshivas are established, as the Novi Yecheskel founded the yeshiva in Sura. Yeshiva in Sura was founded in 597, and it lasted continually till the year 1001. So you're talking about an institution 1,600 years old. If you want to put that in perspective, the oldest educational institution in the Western world is Oxford University, which is about 900 years. Well, I told somebody in Miami this once, he said, 1,600 years, what a deficit they must have had. Well, undoubtedly true. But Bavel became now the seat of Jewish life, and the seat of Jewish learning. The Jews came to Bavel, so originally they came as slaves. There were revolutions. The Ribono Shel Olam overthrew the Chaldean dynasty. Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Evel Merodach, and his sons, they were all overthrown. And in a short period of time, the Persians and the Medes came from the east and overthrew the entire Babylonian Empire, and they became the leading empire. Now, in our understanding of the role of the Jewish people in Eretz Israel, in the ancient world, there were always two empires, the Northern Empire and the Southern Empire. The Southern Empire was 99% of the time Mitzrayim, Egypt. The Northern Empire, sometimes it was Aram, sometimes it was Ashur, Assyria. Sometimes it was Bavel. Sometimes it was Poras. It was Persia. But there always was a northern empire and a southern empire. And who was sandwiched in between the two tremendous empires? The Jews. And what country is the bridge that has to be crossed to get from north to south? Is always the land of Israel. And that's why we are always speaking in the Tanakh, and in the time of the Mishnah, and the time of the Gemara, you're always speaking about constant war. Constant. Because the country sits in the most strategic location. And the people are different people. They are not the Northern Empire, and are not the Southern Empire. We'll see this story will repeat itself with Alexander the Great, with the Romans, with the Greeks, with the Muslims, till our time. And that's why it's always a hot spot. If the Ribono Shel Olam would have wanted, he could have made Eretz Yisrael, let's say, New Zealand, right? Or Northern Canada or some, so then would be, you know, be a Ruach 11 maybe. But where it is located, it is predictable that there's going to be problems. So the Jews were in the northern empire in Bavel, which now became the northern empire of Poras, of Persia, and they were in the southern empire of Egypt. In Egypt, they lived in two main cities. The city that later would be called Alexandria, which then was the city of Thebes. It was an ancient Egyptian city. Memphis, Moph, the city of Memphis. It was always the port at the mouth of the Nile. And the city which today is called Cairo, which then was called Al-Fayyum, which is the middle of the Nile. That's where the Jews lived. So you have Jewish communities, again, till our time, that go back, we're talking 2,700 years that the Jews have been there. In Bavel, when the Persians came, so then life for the Jews became better. The Jews, first of all, were freed from being slaves because the Babylonians were defeated. And the famous handwriting on the wall, the story of the prophet Daniel interpreting it. And the Persians liked the Jews, except they didn't like the Jewish religion. The Persians believed in a form of worship which today we call Zoroastrianism, which is the god of light and the god of dark. And they believed that these two gods were in constant struggle one against the other. Therefore, the Gemara brings, for instance, we all know that Mishnah in Bamei Madlikin, or those that daven Nusach Ashkenaz at least know the Mishnah in Bamei Madlikin, that Hamachabes Aner, person that blows out the candles, Mipnei, so the Gemara lists there, Mipnei Ovdei Kochovim, because of the Goyim. So what does it mean he blows out the candles because of the Goyim? Because there were certain holy days in the Persian calendar that were dedicated to the god of darkness. And on that day, you were not allowed to have a light in the house. And if somebody had a light in the house, so they would kill him, because they held it to be an insult to their religion. So if what it was Friday night, right, and the woman benched licht, and then he hears mobs of Persians, or the police, so he blows out the candle because he's afraid of that. That's the case that the Mishnah is talking about. That's why it says there that he's potter. Not mutter to do it, but if he does it, he's not chayev a korban for the malocha of kibbutz. The Jewish religion really mocked at all of these pagan things. And the Persians deep down in their hearts felt that the Jews were right. And therefore they were very, very uncomfortable with the Jews. The story of Purim, which happens during this period of time, is an example of this discomfort. Doseyam shonos mikolom, vesdoseyam melech einam osim, can't deal with the Jews. And Haman found a ready audience for his anti-Semitic diatribes, and the king himself was willing to let it happen. After the Jews were saved from Purim, by the miracle of Purim, by Esther, and by Mordechai, so here we have the first great discrepancy. There are a number of discrepancies that are hard to deal with. Here we have the first great discrepancy. And that is, the Tanakh tells us that one of the Persian emperors, by the name of Koresh, which is the name Cyrus, granted permission for the Jews to return to Eretz Israel. Eretz Israel lay under the dominion of the Persians. And he granted them permission to return to Eretz Israel and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Which Cyrus are we talking about? The Tanakh does not tell us. Cyrus, the name Darius or Darius, the name Xerxes, the name Artaxerxes, all of those names, Artaxasta, Ahasuerosh, all of those names are not private names. Those are the names that the kings took, like Kaiser, like Caesar, like Paro, like Avimelech. And therefore, Most historians think that there are at least four or five Cyruses. We know there are three Dariuses. We know that there are three Xerxes. Which one are we dealing with? To further complicate the matter, we have a Medrash. The Medrash tells us that Esther Hamalka, Queen Esther, gave birth to a son from King Ahasuerus, and that his name was Koresh. So, technically, according to the halacha, he was Jewish. And he succeeded to the throne of Persia. Which one? So, there are Midrashim Chalukim. There are Midrashim that are mashma, that it's Esther's son that gave the Jews permission, which would be understandable to us. There are Midrashim, however, and Rashi follows the second opinion, that say that there was another Koresh before who gave the Jews permission, and that this Koresh was the one that allowed them to start to rebuild the temple again. Because as we will see, even when they came, they were unable to really begin the effective building of the Beis HaMikdash. So we have one problem. Which Koresh are we talking about? We have a second problem, which is even a greater problem. I'm going to bring it to you next time. I'm going to bring the article for you to read and to take home. Rav Schwab, the Rav of the Kehillas Adas Yeshurun in Washington Heights, in the Jubilee volume called Tiferes Tzvi that was issued in honor of the late Rabbi Breuer's 85th birthday. So the Kehillah published a special volume of articles, etc. So Rav Schwab wrote an article about history, and he points out there the problem that befuddles all historians. The problem is as follows. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in 586. That's when Nebuchadnezzar, the general historical records of the world confirm that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Beis HaMikdash in 586. How long was the Golas Bavel? 70 years. So that means that the second Beis HaMikdash and Ezra and Nehemiah should have been in what year? In 516. The Talmud tells us that the second Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years. We know the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in the year 70 after the Common Era. Well, 516 and 70 is 586 years. There's 166 years off here somewhere. We're 166 years off in the Cheshbon. Now, Rabbi Schwab has an interesting theory there. Rabbi Schwab says that Chazal purposely buried the 166 years for reasons. When you read the article, you'll see it. Not everybody agrees with him, but the problem is a real problem. Some say that it's not a problem because it didn't happen in 586. They add 166 years on to Nebuchadnezzar to make it come out even. But such documents as we have, and as the archaeologists have found and everything, all clearly indicate that it happened in 586. So therefore, the second problem that we have is, when are we talking about? Because if we're talking about Ezra and Nehemiah 166 years later, in other words, Ezra and Nehemiah came to Eretz Yisrael in the year 350 before the Common Era, not 516, so then that's a different ball game. That means the Jews were in Bavel much more than 70 years. And that means the Babylonian Jewish community was much more deeply rooted, and that would help us to understand why so few Jews came. But if we're talking that the Jews could go back within 40, 50, 60 years of their coming to Bavel, so then the question is really a serious question. Out of 500,000 Jews, we're going to see that only 41,000 came. A little reminiscent of our times, perhaps. Then they didn't come because in Bavel they had it better. They had it better economically, better politically, and they had it better religiously. as we're going to see. As I pointed out to you, Bovel had a deep-rooted religious Jewish life. So I'm not going to resolve that problem for you. I have no answers to it, but I'll give you a copy of the article next week, and you'll be able to read it, and it'll point out to you there are certain mysteries, gaps that exist in Jewish history that no one has ever been able to fill in. So we have to wait. The Kiyovo Elio, he'll explain to us what happened there. All right. In any event, Koresh gave permission to the Jews to return. Now, the Jews had what today we would call a shadow government, or a government in exile in Bovel. It was led by a man called Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was descended from the house of David. He was the king. If there would be a monarchy, if the Jews would be restored to Yerushalayim, and there would be a monarchy, he would be the king. And Zerubbabel, with a group of a few thousand Jews, came back there at Israel to Yerushalayim to start the ball rolling to build the second commonwealth. What did they find when they came back? They found the people who lived there that said, "You're not the Jews, we're the Jews." And those people were the Shomronim, the Samaritans. Now, how did the Shomronim get there? Again, the Tanakh tells us that when Sancheiriv, the king of Ashur, destroyed the 10 northern tribes, so Sancheiriv had a policy. His policy was that when he conquered a nation, he took everybody and moved them, and he brought in new people, because he said the new people have no attachment to this country. It's not their homeland. They are less inclined to be rebellious and cause trouble. The Gemara says, Bo Sancheiriv uvilbul es olam. Sancheiriv homogenized the whole world, mixed it all up. Nobody is where they belong anymore. And the Gemara holds that to be such a truism that, for instance, you cannot say that anybody is from Amalek, or you cannot say he's from Ammon or Moab, so that if a goy comes to convert, right, so then you go Bosarov. We go according to the majority of the world. The majority of the world are not Ammon or Moab or Mitzrim or whatever, and therefore you allow them to convert. Because Bosancheirv uvilvul solam. Even the people who live in Ammon or Moab are not Ammonites or Moabites, because Sancheirv moved everybody around. Into Eretz Yisrael, into the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, he brought a people from the island of Crete. The island of Crete is called in the Tanakh Kuta, and therefore Chazal called them Kusim, Kutim, from the island of Kuta. And they called themselves Shomronim because they dwelt in the city of Shomron, in Samaria. They came, they were pagans. They brought with them the Cretan gods. After they were in Eretz Yisrael, a little while, a plague of wild animals, of lions, descended upon them. And the lions used to eat them. So they had a meeting and they said that this plague of lions is because the god of this country is insulted that we are worshiping the god of the country that we came from. And therefore they all got up and they converted and became Jews. Now the Gemara has a machlokas, and this is a machlokas that lasted hundreds and hundreds of years, because the Samaritans were around in the time of the Mishnah yet. So we're talking about a 500 to 600 year problem. One of the important things that we'll see from all of this is that problems don't go away quickly in history. And that when we talk, for instance, about our problems today, the secularization of Judaism, reform, whatever you want to talk about, you're talking about really in history fresh problems. It's only 150 years. It's only 200 years. The problem with the Shomronim took over 600 years to solve. So the Shomronim, their conversion was questioned. So the Gemara has two opinions. One opinion is that they're Gerei Amos, they really are converts, and they really are Jews. The second opinion is that they're Gerei Arroyos, the lions converted them. They didn't mean it. And the Gemara's final opinion, after the 600 years, is that they did not withstand the test of time. They reverted to pagan ways. And because it's Dmusiona Motzalahem, they still worshipped birds, etc. And because of that, the Gemara said they're not Jews. But the question for 600 years was a valid question. And the Gemara discusses whether you can eat the matzah of a kusi. The Gemara says that a many mitzvah that the kusim do, they do better than the Jews do. You can be somech on them 100%. Which we may think is complimentary to them. But the Gemara deep down felt that that's a proof that they're not Jews. Because a Jew is mitzuveh ve'oseh, right? A Jew, we have to do it because we're told to do it. Anytime you're told to do something, your natural inclination is not to do it. That's godel mitzuveh ve'oseh, mish'eino mitzuveh ve'oseh. And since they were not commanded, that's why their matzah was perfect. When Zerubbabel came to Yerushalayim, the Shomronim came and said, "Hey, 1 minute, we're the Jews. Who are you guys? Where are you from? We're not only we're the Jews, we stayed here. You guys went to Bavel." And Zerubbabel said to them, "You're not Jews. Or even if you are Jews, but you're second-class citizens. We're the ones. It's our country, and we're going to build, etc." The Shomronim didn't like that. And the Shomronim therefore mounted a campaign, a twofold campaign. One, a campaign of terrorism. And you'll remember this also, that terrorism is a... It's like apple pie and Chevrolet in the Middle East. I mean, it's a way of life. A campaign of terrorism against the Jews who came back to live in Eretz Israel, and a political campaign back in Persia that the king should revoke the permit. And they were successful. The permit for the Jews to emigrate was revoked. The permit to build the base Amigdash was revoked. According to the Gemara in Megillah, that when Esther said, "Ad chatzi amalchus," that when the king said to her, "I'm willing to do on your behalf, ad chatzi amalchus, till half the kingdom," so the Gemara says half the kingdom means till Yerushalayim. You can ask me anything you want, but don't ask me to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Don't ask me to allow the Beis HaMikdash to be built. That I can't do for you. This demoralized the Jews who came there, as you can well imagine. People come to build a country. People come to build a Beis HaMikdash. They think they have the permission of government. It's all going to go great. They come there. Say, you got a bunch of guys telling them, you're not Jews. Then you got the king in Poros that says, wait a minute, I change my mind. They're sitting there. They have sold their houses in Bovel already. They sold their businesses. What are they going to do? So what happened is that they simply went to pot. They intermarried because there were Goyim who lived in Eretz Yisrael also, many different tribes of Goyim. They intermarried among the Goyim. They became Mechalalei Shabbos. They gave up on themselves and on the Jewish religion and on the future of the Jewish people. So you have here a strange situation. The Jews that are living in Golis that didn't go to Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, they've got the yeshivas and the shul and the neviim and the great men. And there it's strictly Jewish. And the Jews that went to Eretz Yisrael to build the Beis HaMikdash and to rebuild the Second Commonwealth, most of them have foreign wives, alien women, and most of them are not Shomrei Shabbos. And they have despaired of the Jewish future. If you'll think about that also for a while, you will see that the situation has certain moments of resemblance. And that is the situation where we begin our discussion of Jewish history. And the Second Commonwealth begins with one of the greatest people. History is always people. One of the greatest personalities in the history of the world, and that's Ezra HaSofer. Chazal say that if the Torah wouldn't have been given through Moshe, then it would have been given through Ezra. Now, if we knew Ezra's trick, right, what his key was, we could also do it, because we are going to see that Ezra will reverse the situation in a very short period of time. And he does it only through the power of his great personality. Ezra was a Kohen. He was called Ezra HaSofer because he was a scribe. His last name was Schreiber. And he came into the picture as he describes in his own book, in the book of Ezra. We have two books. One is called Ezra and one Nehemiah. In the Talmud, it's only counted as one book. It's called Sefer Ezra. And it's interesting that most of the book is written in Aramaic. The Jews in Bavel spoke Aramaic already. They did not speak Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic. And Aramaic became the language of the Jewish people throughout the Second Temple. And it remained the language of the Jewish people until the Arabs came in the 7th century. So we could say that for almost 12 centuries, the Jews spoke Aramaic. Aramaic then was what Yiddish would be to the Eastern European Jews, or what Ladino would be to the Sephardic Jews. It was the Jewish language. It had different dialects. The Aramaic dialect of Eretz Yisrael is different than the Aramaic dialect of Bavel. You see that? That's the difference between the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi. But it's the same language. The dialect is different, but it's the same language. Ezra said he organized in Eretz Yisrael 40,000, in Bavel rather, 40,000 Jews to come with him. But he could not get the Jews whom he wanted to go with him. He could not get the Talmidei Chachamim to come. He couldn't get the Leviim to come. We'll see that when Ezra came to Eretz Yisrael, a Levi is entitled to Miser, is entitled to the tithe. Ezra took it away. The Gemara tells us Ezra passed a rule that the Leviim get nothing because they didn't come when we needed them. The 10% he took for the Kohanim. The Kohanim and the second base Amigdash got not only Truma, they got Miser as well. Because a Kohen basically is a Levi. He's a super Levi. So halachically, he could have Miser. But he took it away from the Leviim because they didn't come. He couldn't get that element which would have rebuilt Eretz Yisrael the way he wanted it. He couldn't get them to come. And he came and he surveyed this scene. A scene where the intermarriage rate, there are midrashim that say it was 85-90%, that there was only a tenth of the Jews that were not intermarried. So that means, intermarriage means that all the kids in the day school are goyim. I mean, that's the pshat here. It's not just that he's got a goyish wife. It means there are no Jews. And when he came to the city of Yerushalayim, all the stores were open on Shabbos. The gates of the city were open on Shabbos. And they all told them alumdus yet. They told alumdus that Minatorah, there's no Easter to do business on Shabbos. It's not one of the 39 Ovis Malachas, which it is not. Mekach HaMemker. And therefore they said, what's wrong? Or, according to other Meforshim, if the Jews themselves didn't stay in the business, they had Goyim that took care of the businesses for them. And apparently Shabbos was the market day. All the goyim from the neighborhood from the neighboring towns and villages would come on Shabbos to buy. So you have to imagine the scene. Ezra HaSefer, it's like Moshe Rabbeinu coming down from Har Sinai with the Luchos, and there he sees the eagle in front of him. This is a repetition of that scene. Then you have the political problem. They're not allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash. The Shomronim are running the show, and the Shomronim threaten with physical violence Ezra and anybody else that wants to change the situation. Enter the second man. How the Rabboni Shalom does things. The second man that's going to turn the situation around. His name is Nehemiah. Nehemiah ben Chachlia, who was a Jew who rose to very high office under the Persian emperor. And this is Darius. Again, we don't know if it's Darius the second or Darius the third, Doryovish. He was the cup bearer, the Saramashkim. Now, we were taught in the Cheder that the cup bearer is the guy that gave the king the cup. That's right, but that's not much of a job. The man that gave the king the cup was, the national security advisor. Giving the king the cup meant that you guaranteed that it was not poisoned. You guaranteed everything was in order. That was the ceremony of giving the king the cup. That's why the Saramashkim, the Rashi tells us, based on the Gemara and Sota, that the Saramashkim gave Paro, and there was a fly in the cup, so he put him in jail. So what's his fault with the fly? A fly in the cup means that there's a rebellion, there's a conspiracy. You're not doing your job. Your job is to make sure that the king's interests are protected beyond any question. So he was the cupbearer. He was the national security advisor. He was La'avdol, Elef Avdolas. He was what Kissinger, let us say, was to Nixon. He was a person of great influence and great power. Except that unlike later Jews, he was a person that was moved by Ruach HaKodesh. And he went to the king with a very brazen proposition. And the brazen proposition was, my brethren are trapped in a no-win situation in Yerushalayim. There's nobody that can straighten it out for them. Let me go on a leave of absence. I'll straighten it out. I'll help them get settled. I'll help them build Yerushalayim, the base of Midrash, and then I'll come back. Now, in the ancient world, if the king didn't like that idea, you were a head shorter. Because that also is rebellion. I mean, that's really dual loyalty, right? What are you worried about your Yerushalayim when you're working for me here in the palace? When Nehemiah takes the risk, and the king agrees, the king gives him a power of attorney, he gives him carte blanche, and he gives him an army. He gives him members of the palace guard with weapons to go along with him. So when Ezra came, so Ezra comes out to the Rosh Yeshiva, right? So the Shomronim, they didn't get nervous, right? It's another black hat. But when Nehemiah came to town, that's a different story already. Because when Nehemiah came, he came equipped to do battle. And battle is what he does do. He does physical battle, spiritual battle, political and diplomatic battle. So that Ezra and Nehemiah together turn the people around. Nehemiah turns it around physically, and Ezra turns it around spiritually. And we're talking in a 5-year span, the whole thing is done. They call a meeting and they say, okay, guys, you got to send all the Goyish women home. Divorce them all. Either divorce them or they have to convert and be real Jewesses. None of this anymore. Try that. Everybody says, okay. And those that don't say okay, you're out of the community too. We're going to close the gates on Shabbos. No more business on Shabbos. And he closes the gates. He's got the soldiers. No more business on Shabbos. He calls a meeting of the Jewish people together, a convention. It's called Bris Amona. Bris Amona is the covenant of faith. And at the covenant of faith, as described in the Tanakh, Ezra gets up and reads the Chumash Dvorim to the Jewish people. And they all weep, and they all do tshuva, and they're all makabel on themselves, all of these halachas. And Ezra there is mesaken the first of his many great takonas. The takona is no mekach hamemker on Shabbos. No money, no dealing, all of that is osur on Shabbos. That's my takonas Ezra, that's not from Min HaTorah. The Jewish people adopt it. Ezra is mesaken. The Torah should be read every Monday and Thursday. Ezra says the reason they could fall apart like this is because of the fact that it's without Torah. The Jewish people can't go without Torah. So, Kriyas HaTorah, Shabbos morning, that's Min HaTorah. Kriyas HaTorah, Shabbos Mincha, that's the Takona of Moshe Rabbeinu. That was from the desert. Kriyas HaTorah, Monday and Thursday, that's the Takona of Ezra. Ezra also establishes a judicial system in the country. Every Monday and Thursday, the Beis Din sits in every community. People that have problems come Monday and Thursday to the Beis Din. The Gemara in Ksubas says, the Mishnah, famous Mishnah, says that that's why Jewish women, the minig was that they get married on Wednesday nights, so that if there were any problems, they could go to the Beis Din on Thursday. Ezra is mesaken the strengthening of every fiber of Jewish life. But his greatest takona is that he makes a, what we would call today, a legislative body called the Anshe Knesset HaGdola, the men of the great assembly. And the Gemara says that the Anshe Knesset HaGdola was composed of 120 people, of whom Kama were Nevi'im, some of Ezra, Nehemiah, Mordechai, Zerubbabel, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. They were all members of the Anshe Knesset HaGdola, Shimon HaTzadik. I'll tell you an interesting pshat, by the way. It says that Shimon HaTzadik hoyo mishiorei Anshe Knesset HaGdola. He was from the leftovers. What's pshat, the leftovers? So Reb Reuven Margolius says, and it's a historic fact, he proves it. Ezra appointed, there were 120. When one of them died, then there only was 119. They never reappointed again. The Anshe Knesset HaGdola disappeared by attrition. So Shimon HaTzadik was the last one of the Anshe Knesset HaGdola, the last survivor. That's the pshat. He was Mishiorei Knesset HaGdola. He was the one that was left over. So there were 120 great men. As they died, so the Anshe Knesset HaGdola ended. That's the origin, by the way, today, the Israeli Knesset, which they call a Knesset, right? And there are 120 members of the Knesset. That's a direct copy of Ezra's Takona of the Anshe Knesset HaGdola. We're missing in caliber the comparison a little, but the idea is certainly Jewish. The number is Jewish. The idea is Jewish. The Rebbeinu Shalom will help here too. The Anshe Knesset HaGdola became the leadership body of Klal Yisrael. Now Nehemiah attempted to have the king of Persia agree that the Jews could have a king. And if that would have gone through, then Zerubbabel would have become the king. And Malchus Beis David would have been reestablished. But the king of Persia refused. For political reasons, he refused. Because he said the Jews are too independent a people. It's bad enough the way it is. It's bad enough the way it is that they are allegedly ruled from Persia, and that there's a governor there that takes care of it. You let them have a king, it'll never work. So he refused. And the Malchus Beis David was never again reestablished in the Second Commonwealth. Ezra and Nehemiah set about now to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash. The Beis Hamikdash that Ezra and Nehemiah built was, how shall we put it? The Gemara says that on the day that the second Beis Hamikdash was dedicated, so the Gemara says those who remembered or who had heard the stories regarding the first Beis Hamikdash wept, because they said the first Beis Hamikdash was gold and platinum and marble and everything that Shlomo HaMelech could pour into it, cedar and acacia wood, and just it was one of the wonders of the world. People came from the whole world to see the building. The second Beis Hamikdash was puny, was made out of wood. They couldn't afford even to have it made out of stone, out of Jerusalem stone. It was made out of wood, it was potched together, it was primitive. So they wept, because they saw in one stark comparison what the punishment had been, what the Golis was. The second Beis Hamikdash would be rebuilt four times. It would be rebuilt at the end of the reign of Shimon HaTzadik. It would be rebuilt by the Hashmonoim. And then finally it would be rebuilt by Hurdas, by Herod the Great. When it was rebuilt by Herod the Great, when we get there, then the Beis Hamikdash again was the wonder of the world. Because Herod was a great murderer, but he was a great builder. Maybe the two go together. Because sometimes in order to do it, you know, it can't be Mr. Nice Guy, which he certainly wasn't. But his Beis Hamikdash rivaled Shlomo's Beis Hamikdash. But the Beis Hamikdash of Ezra didn't rival anybody's. And it was therefore a source of, on the one hand, consolation, but on the other hand, it was a source of reminder to the Jewish people of how much trouble they were in, and that they were not really independent, and they didn't have money, and they just couldn't put it together. There's an interesting medrash. The medrash says that Ezra refused to collect money for the building of the Beis Hamikdash from outside of Eretz Yisrael. In other words, they could have had, if they would have went to Bovel and had the United Beis Hamikdash appeal in Bovel. So there's no question they could have had a lot, right? Then everybody would have their names, right? We'd have a wall of dedications. They could raise all the money they needed. But he refused to. He built it only with the people whom he had with him in Eretz Yisrael, and they Nebuch didn't have. And therefore the Beis Hamikdash was built without any magnificence to it. The second thing is that the second Beis Hamikdash lacked spiritual magnificence as well. The Gemara says that the second Beis Hamikdash was missing five things that existed in the first Beis Hamikdash. And the five things are those things that testified, kaviyochel, to the presence of the Shekhinah in the Beis Hamikdash. In the first Beis Hamikdash, anybody that walked into the Beis Hamikdash knew that the Shekhinah rested among the Jewish people. The Gemara says that in the second Beis Hamikdash, the menorah, they never found the menorah. Moshe's menorah, the great menorah. You know, you all know the medrash that Moshe couldn't build the menorah. So he took the gold and he threw it in the fire, and out came the miraculous menorah. So that menorah was carried by the Jewish people in the Mishkan all the years, and it was in the Beis Hamikdash of Shlomo. It disappeared. The Gemara says that the earth opened its mouth and swallowed it. There was no menorah. There was no Oren. The Oren HaKodesh disappeared.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. The Aron HaKodesh disappeared, the Luchas HaBris that were in it, the broken pieces of the Luchas HaBris, of the first Luchas, the Tzinsenes Hamon, the bottle of Amon that was preserved, the staff of Aaron from the incident after Korach, all of that disappeared. Wasn't there anymore. There was no Nevuah in the second Beis HaMikdash. The last prophets of Israel were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So Machlokas in the Gemara, who Malachi was. There are three opinions. One opinion is that Malachi was Ezra. Second opinion was that Malachi was Mordechai. Third opinion was that Malachi was Malachi. But he's the last prophet. And from then on, there is no more prophecy. Now, that's a cardinal belief of the Jewish people. When we discuss Christianity later, and Islam, and all the other religions that came afterwards, the first kasha that the Jews said is that there are no more Nevi'im. Nitla Nevuah. The Nevuah was taken away. There is no prophet. There's nobody that can come and say, Ko Amar Hashem. That doesn't exist anymore. You have to realize that for a people who were accustomed to Nevuah, that is a wrenching experience. See, to us, it's nothing. You know, we don't have Nevi'im, we're not missing it. But if you imagine you had the Navi, so the Navi, you could ask things. Now there was no one to ask. The Jewish people were, so to speak, on their own. So the second Beis HaMikdash is a retrenchment of the Hashgacha. Kaviyochel, God withdraws. It becomes a more natural Hashgacha over the Jewish people. It's not the same Hashgacha that was in the first Beis HaMikdash. In the second Beis HaMikdash, there was no Urim V'tumim. They couldn't get the Kohen Gadol's breastplate to work. It wouldn't light up. Now that goes hand in hand with the lack of Nevuah. In order for the Urim V'tumim to work, there had to be a Navi. There had to be, that Koach had to be present. It wasn't there. In the first Beis HaMikdash, the fire that was on the altar was always in the shape of a crouching lion. It was one of the miracles. And when they carried the Mizbeach, in the desert, or they carried it in Eretz Yisrael, the fire never went out, and it never burned the cloth that covered it. That miracle disappeared in the second Beis HaMikdash. Now the Gemara, the Mishnah in Ovos, tells us 10 nisim that existed in the second Beis HaMikdash, that still existed. But the second Beis HaMikdash was missing 5 of the main nisim, which were in the first, 5 of the main artifacts, which were in the first Beis HaMikdash. So that the second Beis HaMikdash had within it physical poverty, so to speak, and it had spiritual poverty as well. And the last point I want to make tonight, again, taken from the Tanakh. Who was appointed the Kohen Gadol? So the Tanakh tells us that the first Kohen Gadol in the second Beis HaMikdash was Yehoshua. It's in the Parsha Baal Oschom. We'll read it for Shabbos Hanukkah, the Haftorah. Roni V'Simchi. So it says there that when the Ribono Shel Olam, when the Novi chose Yehoshua to be the Kohen Gadol, if it says, Hu ayo lovush begodim tzoim. He was wearing dirty clothes. His garments were not clean. So the Gemara asks, what does it mean his garments were not clean? So the Gemara says, because his sons married non-Jewish women. Tushtel Tzachfor, the Kohen Gadol, that goes in lifnayu lifnim on Yom Kippur, and that all Klal Yisrael depends on him, and he has non-Jewish grandchildren. So that's the climate of the beginning of the story of the Second Commonwealth. And that's why we will see that it's such a turbulent time, and that the next 400 years that we are discussing, there is not one year that goes by without revolution, war, internal dissension, strife. It's unbelievable. If the Jews survived the Second Temple, they can survive anything. And a great deal of it is seen simply in the foundation. That's the way it started. That's the way it'd be directed. All right, so next time I'm going to give you, God willing, that copy of Rabbi Schwab's article dealing with 165 years, and we'll begin here from the time of Yeshua and Ezra.